You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. What role did the human factor play leading to the financial crisis? What are the difficulties of regulating shadow banks? In this podcast, you'll learn how the financial system goes awry when risk goes to zero. You'll also learn the meaning of moral hazard and how it played a role in the financial crisis of 2008. Dr. Richard F. DeMong is the Virginia Bankers Association Professor Emeritus at the McIntyre School of Commerce, University of Virginia. Dr. DeMong received a bachelor's degree from California State University at Long Beach, an MBA from the College of William & Mary, and a PhD from the University of Colorado. He is the author of numerous articles on subprime lending, managerial finance, investments, small business, and banking in leading financial and banking journals. Colonel DeMong is a retired United States Air Force pilot. Dr. DeMong spoke at the Wednesday, January 9th, 2013 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Tom Boyd.
Thank you. It's indeed a pleasure to have this opportunity to moderate our program, the first program of January 2013. A few words about senior statesmen. How many visitors do we have here? If you'll just raise your hand. We're delighted that you're here. We're delighted you're here, and we, as Sue said, we'd like to invite you to join Senior Statesmen. We have some brochures and some information in the back. And before you leave, please take that with you. It is my pleasure. Before I go to my introduction, I would like to mention that we have some, if you look at your calendar, upcoming events. February, we'll have Doug Blackman from the Miller Center here. In March, Deborah Gordon, Senior Associate in the Energy and Climate Program of the Carnegie Institute. On April the 10th, we'll have our annual delegate report from the state legislature in the spring, which is always a great program. So we have a lot of good programs for the next 6 months, and that's just a taste, and we invite you to come back and be with us. As I said, it's really an honor and a pleasure for me to introduce our speaker today, Dr. Richard F. DeMong. Rich is the Virginia Bankers Associates Professor of Emeritus at the McIntyre School of Commerce at the University of Virginia. He received his bachelor's degree from California State University at Long Beach and an MBA from William & Mary, and a PhD from the University of Colorado. He is the author of numerous articles on subprime lending, management, managerial finance, investments, small business, and banking in lending and finance in banking journals. It is interesting to note that Rich's first paper on subprime lending was in 1998, just as subprime lending started to take off. He also spoke at the National American Bar Association meeting in August of 2007 on the topic subprime, a correction or a crisis. He argued that the subprime crisis was a long foreseen train wreck only waiting to happen. This speech was more than a year before the credit crunch of September 2008. Rich was invited to speak at the major banking conference in November of 2008 to explain the financial crisis in the United States. And he spoke at the same conference just 2 months ago. Rich has been a longtime resident of the area, and he has given so much. He is a fellow Rotarian, and he has given so much to the community, and we're just delighted he's here. And we look forward to your speech today. Thank you, Rich.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. Yes, sir. It's an absolute pleasure to be here today. I want to talk a little bit about the financial crisis and some of the background so as we can be aware of the conditions that, in effect, influenced it, caused it, and created it so that we can perhaps prevent them in the future. And that really will be my goal today, to give you some of the background and some of the overall economic conditions that created the conditions. And as Tom pointed out, in fact, this is a train wreck that was long developing. And we could have seen it, should have seen it, could have known about it well in advance. But we were optimistic, and that's going to be one of my themes. I'm going to argue that we get into, as humans, an over-optimistic, everything's going to continue just as it is today. And that's not true. So there's my train wreck. You can see it's a recent picture. But I found it nicely describes and illustrates how something can go off track without the proper infrastructure, without the proper regulations perhaps to keep them on track, without the proper behavior of all the players. And one of my points that I'm going to try to illustrate is that at almost every level we had weaknesses, which the economists would call moral hazard, weaknesses in not understanding the risks that people were taking, whether we're talking about the borrowers all the way up to the investors through the lenders. In order to do that, I'm going to have to illustrate that banking has changed since Tom and I started in banking. I started in banking in 1965, before I joined the Air Force and before I went off to teach at the university. But when Tom and I started, a bank would make a loan. Where would the bank get its funds? The bank would get its funds from you all. You would put your savings at a bank, or you'd put your checking account at a bank, and the bank lent it out. That all changed in the 90s and the 2000s. We started moving to what is called securitization, called disintermediation, and all kinds of other fancy terms, which I will illustrate. But what took place is we developed shadow banks. Shadow banks were not only places, but they were also instruments. They were also securities that and many of us have participated in, that a company or an individual could use to raise funds. For an example, one of the early securities that companies used is they set up what were called asset-backed securities. They would, in effect, sell or use as collateral their accounts receivables, the money that we owed to a company, we as consumers, and they would then use that for other purposes. So in effect, they freed up cash by using a security. And that was developed during the 90s and 2000s. But what took place in the 2000s is something that was fascinating. We changed credits. A triple A security is supposed to have a very low default rate. And that's how they define triple A's. And double A's have a little bit more credit risk, but chances are it's not going to default. During the 2000s, late 1990s and the 2000s, we took a bunch of subprime loans. And what is a subprime loan? I have to tell a story about my wife. Many of you know my wife. I was invited to speak down at the National Conference of Subprime Lenders down at West Palm Beach, and the board of directors took us out for dinner two nights in a row, and my wife, flying home, she said, you know, I really like those people. They're making loans to folks with poor credit records below the prime rate. And I said, no, that's not what subprime means. What it means is they're making loans at a higher interest rate to folks that don't have perfect credits. And she said, I don't like those people anymore. Subprimes were originally developed to work with folks that didn't have perfect credit, perhaps because they were artists or entrepreneurs that didn't have a steady income. And if you think about an artist, one year you have a huge amount of money when you sell that big painting, or you get a job on Hollywood in a movie or something,
And it was originally designed for folks that had erratic credit or entrepreneurs that had everything tied up in the business. And a good entrepreneur tries to show as little income as possible so they don't have to pay taxes. But then during the 2000s, subprime loans were starting to be sold to anybody and almost everybody, and that got us in trouble. But what the lenders did is they took all of these subprime loans that had a higher default rate than a typical mortgage that you and I would have, put them all together in a security, and said, well, we now have diversification, so this is a AAA. Wait a minute. If you've got loans that are likely to fail, how do you call it? They changed the credit. And people were buying them thinking, well, these are AAA rated securities. I don't need to look behind and see what's in them. I'll just buy it. Well, many of them were not diversified at all. They were in one city, one town. And so if house prices drop in that one town, those loans are going to fail. And sure enough, they did. The other thing that took place in the late 90s and 2000 was many of the lenders started using short-term financing for long-term investments. They were using short-term financing because they said, hey, I can always sell this security. House prices are going to go up to the sky anyway. There's no limit to house prices. And so they financed these subprime loans, in effect, with short-term funds. And we're going to see that one of the things that happened in September and October of 2008 is many of these lenders, including at that point some of the large investment banks, couldn't roll over their short-term debt, and so they couldn't meet their obligations. And the last is the maturity transformation, which again is the same argument as the liquidity. And all this was taking place outside of the regulated banking system. And that is another big change that took place in the 1990s and 2000s. Much of the lending moved outside. And at one point, it was 80% of lending, not just mortgage lendings, but all lending, was outside of the regulated commercial banks that you and I know and love. But anyway, to set it up a little bit, I'm going to talk about the financial crisis, moral hazard, but I need to look at the history a little bit. So we'll talk about the real estate prices, which peaked in 2006, 2 years before most of us became aware of the financial crisis. The subprime crisis started in early 2007. We had an earlier version of it in 2000, but early 2007. So again, it was more than a year and a half before most of us became aware of it. What is often overlooked is we were in a recession as early as December of 2007. And so the crisis took place 9-10 months later, but we were already in a recession, which indicates that the spending had dropped, and so any weak players anywhere in the system are going to have problems, and sure enough, they did. The liquidity crisis in September, October, most folks look at it as when Lehman Brothers failed on September the 14th, 2008, but yet you could also go back to look at Bear Stearns' failure in April of 2008, and the government, through the Federal Reserve, helped Bear Stearns find a savior, but that didn't happen for Lehman, and there's questions about why the U.S. financial regulators saved one and not the other. Tom talked about the speech I gave in Germany in November 2008, and that was their big question. Why did Secretary Paulson save Bear Stearns but not Lehman? And look what it has done to the German economy in this after the crash. And then in 2008, starting again in September, we had, in effect, a credit crisis. Nobody could borrow, not consumers and not one bank to another bank. I mean, we didn't know who was going to be next. If a layman can fail, who's next? So I'll talk about the events that lead up to it, and the difficulties that we will always have regulating shadow banks. You know, the only way to truly regulate something is to prevent all innovation, and we don't want to do that, so it's always going to be a balancing act, so we'll play with that a little bit. But let's look at the real estate crisis. This goes back to 1880, all the way to 2011 and into 2012. And if you notice the top blue line, house prices stayed fairly flat. I mean, you had the huge drop during the Great Recession, and then after World War II, when the GIs came back, you had a housing need, and so prices went up. But for the most part, you could draw a line across. Let's see if I can get it to work. You can draw a line just about flat for the most part. I mean, again, you had huge jumps, and so it increased right after World War II, and then you can see the population grew dramatically after World War II, and especially in the 60s and 80s. And so there was some reason for house prices to go up. We had the inflationary environment of the 60s and 70s, but for the most part, house prices stayed in somewhat of a range until the late 90s, 2000. And as I said, they peaked in 2006. Look at that growth rate. That dominates any other change in the last 100 years. And my mother, late mother-in-law, always said, if you're going to make money, it's going to be in real estate. That's the only place to make money. And in her period of investing, from the late 30s all the way to the late 2000s, real estate did just go up. But it went irrationally up during 2000. And the other lines here, the population is in red, and building cost, which didn't go up as rapidly as house prices. And so we had this mentality that house prices only go up because that's all they've done for the last decade. We seem to forget history, and it's a constant refrain that we Americans and people in general forget history. Interest rates were the bottom line, and you see that they dropped off, which made houses even more affordable and therefore could go up. Isn't that the truth? Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And that's actually why I wanted to talk today, to make sure that we don't repeat it. And the four most dangerous words in the English language, it's different this time. And again, we heard it with the real estate. It's different this time. Yes, house prices will go up forever. All I have to do is buy this house and I can flip it next week. Give me a break. But anyway. So I want to talk about the lenders in subprime. And so I've listed the top 10 lenders in 2003. And you see that with the exception of City Financial and Wells Fargo, they're all non-commercial banks. Yes, there is one savings and loan that was regulated as a thrift. But predominantly, the lenders were outside of the regulated banking system. They were outside of the restrictions about how much debt you could take on. They were outside of the restriction about what level of assets you had to have on your books. When I started in banking, we worried about the bank examiners. I'm sure Tom worried about them on numerous occasions. But these financial institutions didn't have to worry about it. They had to report to their shareholders. And what do shareholders want? They want profits. So let's go after the most profitable thing that we can find. And that's exactly what was taking place. So most of them were not financials. Here's General Motors. General Motors' acceptance was into real estate and in subprime. They were number 10. Again, they were outside of the normal regulatory system. I've got two charts to try to illustrate the growth of subprimes. This first chart, the solid line is subprimes as a percentage of total mortgages. And it goes from 1996 to 2008. and you see the huge growth as a percentage of total mortgages. It got up to 23.5%, and some folks say 24.1%, but somewhere well over one-fifth of all mortgages were subprime. Does that make any sense? Do we have one-fifth of the American population as artists or entrepreneurs that don't have a steady income? No, it made no sense at all. Alan Greenspan said he was picking up a trade publication and saw the statistic that it was 24.1% were subprime loans in 2006. And he said, I was absolutely astonished. Well, I don't know what publication he was reading, but one of my articles had 24.1% in it. But anyway, the regulators weren't keeping track of it for the most part. There were some that were very aware of it, and some states and some in Congress were pushing hard on trying to control it. So you see this huge growth as a percent of total mortgages. And here's another way of looking at the subprime problem. This chart on this side is subprime variable rate loans. And you see that the interest rate started to jump dramatically in 2005 of the variable rate that people had to pay on their loans. And these are folks that didn't have a steady income. You're jacking up the interest rate because they signed up for a variable interest rate, which would go up. How are they going to afford it? Well, I didn't know it was going to go up. Nobody told me it was going to go up. Well, yes, it does go up with flexible interest rates. I love this chart. This shows the defaults of loans, the serious delinquency of loans, months from origination. And what it shows is from 2007, you started to see almost 2.5% of the loans that were made in 2007 that were seriously delinquent in 5 months. Seriously delinquent defines a loan that is 4 months past due. These folks never made a payment. New Century found that 2.5% of the loans, the borrowers never made the first payment. They couldn't afford the first payment, let alone the variable interest rate, which would start up. And in 2006, you see the same phenomena, a little bit slower. It didn't hit 10% until 1 year after the loan was made. I made good for my 30-year mortgage by paying just the first, in effect, first 8 months, and then I quit. We had fair warning. 2005, the same type of thing. Now, why look at those years? It actually got worse in 2008, 2009. But why look at those years? Those are the years, 2006, 2007, 2008, that the big commercial banks got into subprime lending. Those are the years that they started buying the big subprime lenders. When everything was falling apart, they jumped in. So I showed you the list of the lenders in 2003, but I wanted to quickly show you what happened to them. Ameriquest was bought by Citigroup in 2008, well after the market had collapsed. Citigroup said, hey, this is a good business to be in. We better jump in it. New Century went bankrupt in April of 2007. It was the second largest lender at the time. But as I said, almost 3% of the loans didn't make the first payment, and 15% of the loans in January of 2007 were delinquent, were totally delinquent in 3 months. So they went bankrupt. City Financial hung in there, of course, until we saved them with TARP. Household Finance was acquired by HSBC in 2003, so they were one of the early ones in. It's been a disaster for HSBC. Option One was bought by H&R Block. What do they know about banking? First Franklin bought by Merrill Lynch, who then was rescued by Bank of America and September 14, 2008. Washington Mutual was put into receivership by FDIC, Countrywide acquired by Bank of America, and I laugh a little bit. It cost Bank of America a little over $4 billion. Up to this point, they have spent $40 billion in losses or legal fees or settlements, and most folks estimate it'll probably end up at least at $50 billion for that $4 billion purchase. And I don't know about you, but if I buy something, I don't want to have to pay 10 times for it later. But Wells Fargo's hung in there all right, and actually they're growing dramatically now. And then GMAC was rescued by the U.S. taxpayers, and it's now called Ally. And you see their ads on television. I showed this chart a minute ago, and I showed it to try to illustrate the huge growth in subprime lending. But I want to illustrate another point. The solid black lines are the traditional sources of financing. That's the traditional type of banking, and it's called non-securitized. That is, an underwriter would say, yes, we'll make that loan, and we'll hold it on our books. The white box are where the funds come from selling securities, collateralized debt obligation, collateralized mortgage obligations, asset-backed securities. They had many different names. But that's what took place in 2000s, this huge growth of securities bought by often foreign investors. As a matter of fact, in April of 2006, the Wall Street Journal had a front page story about the subprime difficulties and said, well, it's not a big deal because most of the securities are bought by foreigners, so who cares? All right. I don't know about you, but we're in a global society. But look at the huge growth in the sources of funds coming from securities rather than coming from a traditional banking system where a lender, including a finance company, would raise funds and then lend it out. They were doing it through securities that were sold, and some of them were the types that I described earlier, where you put all these loans together and then sell them as a package. And many of them, as I said, were foreign investors. But it's a huge growth. Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve Chair, said that it was a liquidity glut that he didn't understand. Why is all the money coming in to buying these? And we did have he called it a liquidity glut, and the other term he used was a savings glut coming from foreigners. U.S. consumers weren't saving money, but foreigners were. I mean, you see in Japan, the savings rate was 40 cents per dollar earned at work. Most of us are likely to save 4 or 5% of what we earn. But anyway. And at one point in 2004, and this not just this is just subprime. This is all type of loans. 80% were securitized. Mortgages weren't quite that high, but it's a change in the traditional business model from the days when a bank would use your savings and your credit, your checking accounts as a source of loans. Here's another chart to illustrate the same point. This is non-agency, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, just securities that were sold. And you notice that they grew during the 80s and a little bit in the 90s, but then you a huge shift upwards of securities being sold. The same type of chart that we saw with the subprime money that was coming in. So here's the money that was coming in, and it was being lent to borrowers that didn't have a good credit record. And what we found happening in 2000s was not only borrowers that didn't have a steady income, didn't have a good credit record, but it was borrowers who said, hey, I don't want to take the time to fill out an application. just put down there that I've got some income. And the mortgage broker would say, how much income? Well, what do I need to buy this $500,000 or $600,000 or $700,000? Well, you need to have an income of $80,000. Well, then put down $80,000. And we had the no document loans, and I'll show you another chart. And that took place right in this period because there was so much money coming in that we might as well use it. And what made it even more interesting is the collateralized debt obligations created their own demand for more securities, and so it just accelerated, and you see that. Here's another way of looking at the subprime mortgage growth. As Tom said, I started in 1998, and at the time, the thing I was trying to do in the paper was to give a definition of subprime, because all kinds of lenders were using different terms. Some called it alternate A or alt A. Some called it A minus paper. Some called it B paper, C paper. And so I tried to define the FICO scores that represented it in 98. But then I wrote it. My last paper was in 2004, where I showed the tenuous relationship between the returns that lenders were getting versus the risk they were taking. And that got worse after we quit writing on it in 2005, 2006, 2007, because all that money was coming in that had to be used and lent out. The other thing that changed during the 2000 is an emphasis on deal flow rather than credit analysis. If you think that house prices will go up forever, then there's no risk in taking out this loan because you know you could sell your house for double next year or triple or whatever the irrational thoughts came to mind. And people thought that house prices would go up at a very fast rate. And so, therefore, there was no real risk to me as a borrower. Well, go the next step. The underwriter, the lender says, well, there's no risk to me because if you default, I'll just sell your house for twice its value because prices will go up forever. So the underwriter didn't have any risk. And not only that, the underwriter said, I'm going to sell a security and I'll get my money out of it in a couple weeks anyway. So I'm only worried about the first couple weeks. The investment banks that packaged the securities together said, well, we don't have any risk because we're going to sell it to consumers and foreigners because there's a huge demand for these papers because they're all AAA rated. And the investors said, well, there's no risk for me because they're all AAA rated and I'll just sell it to a bigger fool than me. So everybody had this mentality that there was no risk. And I would argue that, in fact, when you have a feeling that there's no risk, then your behavior changes. And as the economist calls this moral hazard, the way I like to describe it, it's greed without fear. You know, supposedly we invest based on greed and fear, but if you don't have any fear, if you don't have any worries about risk, then the only thing that'll take over is greed, and that's what we saw happening at all levels, from the borrowers all the way up. And you hear stories about house cleaners buying 2 and 3 apartment complexes because they knew they could flip them and they could get the loans from it. And there was one story about a migrant farmer in California whose best year he earned $17,000. He bought a $700,000 house. A lender gave him $700,000 based on an income level of $17,000 because that house price next year will be $1,400,000. It'll double in a year. Yeah, right. So we had an emphasis on deal flow, and everybody was making a fee. The mortgage broker was getting a fee, and as a matter of fact, the mortgage broker would get a higher fee if they got you into a riskier loan. They got a fee, what we would call a kickback, but was called yield spread at the time, from the lender if they could get them into a riskier and a higher interest rate loan. The underwriter would get a fee for making the loan and selling that loan to the investment banker, who would then get a fee for putting the package together to the investors. And so everybody was getting a profit in their mind with no risk. We had a huge growth in the 2000 mortgage brokers. When I took out my first mortgage, I went to the banks in the town and I said, what's the best deal I could get? And they told me, and I borrowed from a savings and loan. But in the late 1990s, 2000s, instead of going to a bank, you just went to a mortgage broker, and he or she filled out all the paperwork, so you didn't have to do that. And they said, we'll get you the best deal possible. Well, that mortgage broker is getting a kickback for getting you into a high-cost loan, and perhaps didn't explain it as well as the savings and loan lender that I first borrowed back in 1975. Explained it to me, and here's what you're going to be responsible for. Here's your payment every month. We thought that market discipline, and Chairman Greenspan has talked about the fact that his perception was self-regulation, self-preservation would take over, and people would not take, lenders and investors would not take abnormal risk. But what we found is that market discipline did not quickly replace the traditional caution of a lender. You know, I can think of in the bank that I started with, the lenders were very cautious because they knew that if that loan went bad, they would have to explain to the credit department or to their boss why that loan went bad. Whereas here, since everybody's selling the security, you don't even remember that it went bad. I don't even remember that that was one of mine because I have no responsibility. I've sold it, and it's somebody else's problem, not mine, which leads to this changed behavior where you react without fear. The factors that accounted for the growth, I've already talked about a little bit. The liquidity was there. It developed dramatically. But let me go the next step and talk about some of the sources of funds. We broke it down, and I'm standing right in the way. We broke it down, the collateralized debt obligations were broken down into groups. And so you had senior, mezzanine, and equity. And if I wanted to buy a AAA, I would buy the senior portion of that collateralized debt obligation. But since prices are going to go up forever, I could take the equity version of it, get a higher interest rate, and know that since house prices go up forever, I'll be able to sell it without any loss. We thought we were transferring the risk to those that were most willing to bear the risk, but the famous economist in the 50s, Errols, said that you should have securities that match the desires of investors at different levels. But what really was taking place is we perceived that there was no risk, but risk doesn't go away. It's still there. And here's just another chart showing the growth of the securities. And here's a chart that illustrates how much of the money that was coming in was foreign money. And you see the top numbers, $1 trillion. And in 2006, we were close to $1 trillion coming from foreign investors. This is a chart that tried to show the irrationality of interest rates. You would expect interest rates to match the risk. Higher risk borrowers should have a higher interest rate. Low risk borrowers should have a lower interest rate. And this chart was trying to illustrate that you didn't have the traditional, back here in 2007, you didn't have the traditional difference between risky securities. And so that risky borrowers could borrow at a relatively low interest rate. And Alan Greenspan so elegantly put it, low credit spreads ain't gonna continue. And he was right, they didn't continue. 2008, that whole chart flipped over, and risky borrowers couldn't borrow at any interest rate. We ended up with a lot of competition. When you have a lot of profits and no risk, what does it attract? It attracts everybody else because, hey, if New Century can make all this money, I can too, because I'm just as bright as New Century. I pick on those because they were one of the first to fail. But and as you get competition, what happens? We're typically, in economics, we talk about pricing drops. In this case, we're talking about interest rates. And so we lowered the credit standards because I need to make that loan. And so if I have too tight of a standards, I'm not going to be able to make the loan. And the only way I can make money is if I make the loan, because that's where I get my fee. And house prices are going to go up forever, so I might as well make my fee and not have any risk. We went from the traditional 80% down, 20% down, 80% borrowed, to close to 100% borrowed. As a matter of fact, the mortgage brokers got a higher fee if they could convince you to borrow 100% of the value of that house rather than just 80%, because they did 80% as the first mortgage and 20% as the second mortgage, and they got a higher fee for that. And so encourage people, take money out, go ahead and spend it, buy that big flat screen HD television, buy a bigger house, we'll lend you all the money, we'll lend you 100%, you don't have to put any down, you know. Lower FICO scores, you know, we were seeing loans for folks with FICO scores in the low 500 range, which meant that you probably defaulted on your last mortgage. If you default on the last mortgage, you're probably going to default on this mortgage, but we forgot that because there's no risk. Teaser rates, they would give a very low interest rate for the first 2 years and then be variable, and that's, I showed that chart where in 2007 the variable rates jumped dramatically. We had steering by the brokerage firms, the mortgage brokers steering people into high interest rate loans. We had speculators galore buying houses expecting to flip them over, and all was based on over-optimistic investors and borrowers because there's no risk. And then we did have some fraud, although it's not been prosecuted. You would think there's fraud, there would be prosecuted. Here's my moral hazard that I described earlier, greed without fear. And that changes behavior, according to the 1950s Kenneth Arrows, the economist. And you could see it at all levels of the mortgage business, and I'll re-illustrate that in a minute. But this, I love this quote, moral hazard can lead intelligent people astray. The Pinocchio story or something, but anyway. And here's the looser standards, and as I showed earlier, traditionally in the 90s, even in the 90s, people were borrowing a little less than 80% of the value of the house, but that continued up to about 85%. And then the percentage of loans without documentation or low documentation, I don't even have to show you my last year's tax records. I don't have to show you my W-2. Just trust me. That's how much I earned. I'm a millionaire. Trust me. Just make me this loan. It was over 40% of the loans had low or no documentation. Now, remember back when I showed you the statistic of the subprime loans were about 25% of the total mortgages? There were some prime borrowers that were able to get without documentation as well. But for the most part, these are subprimes. 7 years later, house prices are finally going back up, and we've all lived through that drop. But I would also argue that regulation played a role. As I said, these securities were outside of the regulated banking system, and there is a reason for having a regulated banking system in the traditional sense. One of the best books was recently written by Sheila Bair, who is the chair of FDIC, And she was describing speaking to an industry group in 2009, and she pointed out these loans that were given to folks that could not and would never be able to pay them back. And she simply said, why did you make loans that could never be paid back? Loans to borrowers that couldn't pay it back and missed, couldn't even pay the first payment. And one of the lenders stood up and said, bad regulation. You mean if you let me jump off the Empire State Building, then it's okay if I jump off the Empire State Building? My mother said, no, I couldn't do that. But yeah, and so we had a limitation of regulation. We were going through a period of deregulation. That was the era starting in the late 70s, 80s, and 90s, where we deregulated and we took many of the constraints off commercial banks in 99. But how many folks recognize this picture? I got several of them, and he is Jack Abramoff. I would argue that he played a role in this disaster, and here's my argument. And not a direct role, but in effect, it created the problem. It was very clear, you know, Jack Abramoff, for those that don't know his story, was taking money from Indian tribes and claiming that he was going to be able to change all the rules and regulations, and bought off at least one congressman, we think multiple, but only one has gone to jail, and a lot of congressional staffs to get his way. But I was asked, as Tom described, to testify before this Congress, two different subcommittees, in May of 2004. And at the time, there was a lot of state pressure to regulate predatory lending and other subprime abuses. And I had studied subprimes, and I had a lot of data on subprime lenders, primarily the New Centuries, the Countrywide, Golden West, Wells Fargo, and the like. And I made the argument that it should be a national law rather than every state and every city making their own predatory lending laws. And this was against the deregulation era. But the industry was willing to go along with it. And Bob Ney, the congressman from Ohio, the Republican chair of the subcommittee, and Ken Konorski, the congressman from Pennsylvania, Democrat, had a bipartisan bill that the industry supported and would have regulated some of the abuses of subprime, so we would not have had this crash. Well, Bob Ney was Congressman A in the Jack Abramoff scandal, and that scandal broke shortly after that testimony. Bob Ney lost his credibility, and as I said, eventually ended up in prison. But it would have been tough even then to get around the regulation. I'll do questions at the end just to, because I want to make a couple other points. And that is, so we didn't have the regulation. It could have, we would have probably still had the recession. We would have probably still had somewhat of a crisis because even in 2004 it had become irrational, but nowhere near what it became. This is what was forgotten. What was forgotten is taught in the first finance course at any college, and that is that if you take more risk, you should get a higher return. That was forgotten at all levels because everybody assumed there was no risk. Therefore, if I can get a higher interest rate, I'm going to go for it because there's no risk. Well, that risk doesn't go away. I love this. This is from a very successful private equity company, Carlyle. And the co-founder, Bill Conway, said, there is so much liquidity, what Alan Greenspan called the savings glut. There's so much liquidity in the world's financial system that even our lenders are making very risky credit decisions. And that's in January of 2007. Again, we had huge advance notice of the upcoming crisis when even Carlyle's lenders were making risky decisions. The institutional investor in April of 2007, until recently, the U.S. mortgage world was characterized by extreme recklessness. Again, well before it collapsed. The rating agencies played a role. The rating agents, so let me describe the moral hazard at every level. The borrowers assumed that there was no risk because house prices would go up, so I can take too big of a loan because I can know that I can always refinance it. And as a matter of fact, when I refinance it, the lenders got a second fee. The mortgage brokers got their fee for filling out the paperwork for you and with you, and then they were out of it. The lenders got their money from investment banks, which collected an interest rate for lending, but again, that was no risk to them in their mind because they were going to sell that paper instantly to the investment banks who were going to put it together and create collateralized mortgage obligations, collateralized debt obligations, and other derivatives. But there was no risk to them in their mind because they were going to sell it to investors. So they were collecting a fee for creating these securities. The rating agencies were rating these AAA securities, and they're collecting their fee. There's no risk because we're going to be out of it. We're just making a rating, and if it defaults, so what? It's not our problem. Well, it should. I mean, you got a reputation. And the investors, I talked about foreign investors, but they were individuals, they were institutions, they were hedge funds, they were private equity. You would think that they would be aware of what they're investing in, but they were going on the AAA rating, because we don't have to look behind it, because it's got a AAA rating, so it's got to be good. And then the service providers, these were the original lenders in many cases that collected the mortgage payments every month. They didn't think they had a risk because as long as the money's coming in, I'm collecting my fee, and if it doesn't come in, I'm not holding the paper. These folks are holding the paper. So these are the ones that are going to get stuck, not me. So everybody assumed I'm going to get my fee with no risk. As I suggested, the deregulation of derivatives started in 96, and again, it was institutionalized in late 1999 and 2000. There were no regulated limits on leverage of these subprime lenders. Many of them had 40, 50, 60 times leverage. That is, they put in a dollar and they borrowed $60 to lend out, but it was no big deal because we're going to sell it as a security and get rid of it anyway. But even the large investment banks, the Goldmans, the Lehmans, the Bear Stearns, were at 30 and 40 times leverage, where a traditional bank is at best 8 times. You have a certain amount of capital, and today the capital has been increased globally. And there were no regulated credit standards for these regulators. I just listed many of the lenders of mortgages and other commercial loans, but I wanted to illustrate that some of these instruments go back to 1917. Repurchase agreement was another form of raising funds. The securitization started in 1970 with asset-backed commercial paper, mortgages, equipment leases, credit card debts, and it just increased. Money market funds, which many of us have invested in, were lending, in effect, to the lenders, finance companies, investment banks. So many of these have been around forever. The difference was we took it to another level and created a monster over time. Let me move now from the crisis and look at what took place afterwards. This is an illustration. The traditional banks is the dark blue line, and the outside of banking system, the shadow banks and shadow banking instruments, is the dotted red line. But what I wanted to illustrate with this chart is when we talk about the crash and banks not making loans, the banks continue to make loans, not as fast as they were before. But the real crash took place in these unregulated securities. That's where the money dried up instantly. That's where one bank couldn't sell a new security. So the traditional banking continued to make some loans, and yes, it became more difficult and the standards got high, but they continued. So most of the financial crash were these unregulated instruments and finance companies. This illustrates the same point. This is 2008, 2009, and you see the huge crash in the collateralized debt obligations, the CDO, the light yellow, the asset-backed securities, the next bar down, the commercial mortgage-backed securities, and the residential mortgage-backed. They just disappeared in 2008, 2009. So, you know, everybody blames Wall Street, but many of the finance companies were California or Washington. They were West Coast. And many folks blame the banks, but a lot of it was, most of it was outside of the traditional banks. Another way to illustrate the same point, you see the shadow bank assets drop dramatically fourth quarter of 2008. First quarter of 2009, whereas traditional banks, the bank assets, continued fairly flat. Yes, there was a little bit of a dip, but not much. The Financial Crisis Inquiry report talked about the lack of regulation and used the highway metaphor. What could one expect on a highway where there were neither speed limits nor neatly painted lines? Because they weren't regulated. And I would argue that we're always going to have trouble regulating because of the lobbying that takes place. And I would argue that most of the shadow banking market have infinite resources because you can hire a lot of bright lawyers, whereas regulators have a finite number of regulators. And the high-priced lawyers will often overcome and outwit the relatively inexperienced or perhaps not as well-paid regulator. Steve Rattner, who is often is a pundit on the morning shows, CNBC this morning, were saying that regulators, by definition, can't understand what the banks can't understand. And he was arguing that the banks today are so complex, and he was using Citibank as his example, that there's no way that a regulator could understand what was going on if the bankers themselves don't understand. You will always have innovation to get around the rules. The 401ks, in effect, was put in. Many of us are using that as an investment vehicle. It was, in effect, a loophole that somebody said, hey, we can use this as a retirement account, and it's worked fairly well. The intellectual capital of regulators versus the high-priced lawyers, and then to make it even worse, what's the best lobbyist that you can hire? Somebody that started at the SEC or the IRS or the FDIC. And so you have a revolving door. And then the incentives are there for the firms and individuals to find ways to get around the rules. And so by definition, it's always going to be tough to regulate. And then, of course, we have the ethical lapses or the moral integrity that is no longer perhaps in the market as it once was. And then now we have the judicial system trying to overcome and to get around the regulations that are starting to be put from Dodd-Frank. Only about a third of the regulations in Dodd-Frank have been implemented, and people are getting around it. So what I've tried to argue is that these same problems could come back. We have to be aware of moral hazard. That is, if you don't have some way to be accountable, then you're probably going to get around it. You're probably going to be like a teenage boy trying to find a way to get around the rules, and whether they're parental rules or alcohol or whatever, we're going to find a way to get around it. I've also tried to argue that some of the conditions that, in effect, influenced the financial crisis were years before, and they were based on good intentions that went awry. Have I addressed all of the causes of the financial crisis? No. Clearly you have others. Clearly you have the Community Responsibility Act of 1977, which encouraged banks to lend to everyone. That was an attempt to overcome redlining, where banks just avoided certain areas, and it was argued that it was racial discrimination, which it probably was. You had Fannie and Freddie Mac, but again, they were latecomers. They, like the commercial banks, didn't get into subprimes until 2006, 2007, 2008, so they got in when it was crashing. We had congressional and presidential emphasis on home ownership, and we've had that for the last 40 years, and our society supposedly is better with more home ownership. I would argue that to an extent, that a mobile workforce and often is a more resilient workforce. So we had other issues that created it, but I would argue that subprime was one of the first and most obvious beginning of the crisis. Subprimes crashed before we went into recession, and subprimes crashes were a function of two factors. One, the high real estate prices started dropping in 2006, and two, interest rates started to go up. But let me open up for questions on any aspect. Thank you, Tom.
I'd like to give the ground rules here for our questions this afternoon. There are two gentlemen who have microphones who will, if you will raise your hand, they will come to you. We would like for you to speak into the microphone. We're recording today's session, so we need you to talk into the microphone. So if you will raise your hand, Bill is on one side over here, John on the other, and they will come to you with the microphone. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Yes, sir.
Congressman Bliley spoke to this very group and said that if the repeal of Glass-Steagall didn't work, he would personally come back and change things. Well, he took his pension and went home. But is that not the root of what we're really talking about? And was it not a change through money, lobbying? And once again, the voter got rolled. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that we got rolled. Glass-Steagall was put in 1933, and it broke up the large banks at the time and broke them into three groups. You had the commercial banks, which are what you and I have come to know and love, and that is they have your checking account and savings account. You had investment banks, which would help companies sell securities, and you had merchant banks that did their own proprietary lending. And the Graham Bliley Leach Act of 98, somewhere in, I think 98, allowed commercial banks to get into investment banking and to get into subprimes and everything else by buying finance companies as part of the holding company. And actually, it was already falling apart even before that act was passed, in that the Federal Reserve allowed Citibank to become this big umbrella with an insurance company and a commercial bank, and so it was already, I would argue that the Federal Reserve probably weakened it even before Congress did. But yes, that allowed the commercial banks, first with HSBC in 2003, and then with Wachovia, Bank of America and some of the other large banks buying the subprime lenders in 2006, 2007, 2008 when they were collapsing. So you're absolutely right. And you wonder whether people second-guess themselves, which is what you suggested with coming back. But I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't come back, so.
Where in the calculation does or do inflated appraisals come in, if they come in, particularly related to the drop in home values?
Yeah, that's a great point. And again, we saw in the 2000 home prices going up forever. And when you all borrowed for your house, you had to get an independent appraiser to come in and determine whether the house was worth what you're paying for it. And if the number came in too low, the bank said, hey, look, you're going to have to either increase your down payment or we're not going to make the loan. I would argue that the appraisers got into the same moral hazard in that they collected their fee. House prices are going to go up forever anyway, and so I don't have to worry about whether I overestimate. And I'm getting pressure from the real estate agent, pressure from the lenders, and pressure from the borrowers to have a higher number. And probably one difference with the appraisers versus mortgage brokers is the appraisers have a strong professional association that tries to self-regulate, and they have strong state laws, whereas the mortgage brokers often were regulated by the states, but they didn't have the same level of pressure. So, yes, it played a role, and a very important role, because if they got into the same belief that house prices are going to go up forever, they would have the same tendency to overappraise. And that's exactly what happened. And then take it the next step. As an appraiser, I know if I'm too tough, that lender is not going to ask me to come back and appraise the next deal. So I'm going to lose some of my future business. So I have another incentive to be a little bit too high. But yeah. And then it dropped. And what was interesting is there was a lag before they started dropping their appraisals. I mean, we saw that across several states. And luckily for us, the assessors also lagged, which, well, not lucky for us, it's worse. Our tax payments were too high. But yes, I mean, that did play a role. Yes, ma'am.
I understand that the banks can make a profit when they borrow at near zero interest rates and lend at 3.5%. But who buys the mortgage, a 30-year mortgage, at 3.5% from the banks?
That's the most amazing thing. Our interest rates in the U.S. are historically at a very low level. People are now lending to the U.S. government with inflation, Treasury inflation-protected securities at a negative return after inflation. And if you're... if you're buying a Treasury security right now, which has hopefully a zero default risk, we hope, but if you're buying a Treasury at 0.15% interest and inflation right now is close to 2%, you're losing money every year. Those same folks are also lending to the lenders to do mortgages because they're saying, hey, I get 3.5%. Whereas if I lent to the U.S. government, I'm only getting 0.15%. It got down to almost zero for a period of time. And we still have a liquidity glut, a savings glut, coming from foreign investors. The other thing which we're seeing is a large amount of U.S. investors are pulling their money out of stocks and putting them into very low-rate bonds. And what they don't realize is that stocks have done quite well the last two or three years. But again, people are buying them. So the same thing that caused the financial crisis will probably cause a future crisis.
You mentioned trying to learn from history.
Yes.
There was a financial panic in 1907, which I'm told was caused by derivatives, which apparently then were soon outlawed until, as you showed in your chart, 1996 to 2000. Can you make any parallels between that panic and the recent crisis?
Well, the most interesting thing about the 1906-07 crisis is J.P. Morgan called in all the bankers and locked the doors of his library and said, we're going to solve this before anybody leaves this room. And he wouldn't let them out. So we had, at the time, somebody that had that power. And I'm not sure we have anybody with that power now. The one thing that has changed, and I'm glad you reminded me, Dodd-Frank has moved or is suggested that banks not be allowed to sell derivatives. There's a story in this morning's, I think, New York Times. It was in Bloomberg, that hasn't been implemented yet. It's called the Volcker Rule after the former Federal Reserve Chief Paul Volcker. Now the issue is, what do we do with the foreign banks? Do we give them the same taxpayer backup if they don't sell derivatives as we do with U.S. banks? Because one of the things that has changed is we're restricting banks. The Dodd-Frank will restrict banks from selling derivatives for their own accounts. But what do we do about foreign banks selling them for their own accounts? And then we've gone one step farther and said, not only do commercial banks have taxpayer support, but the clearinghouses that clear these derivatives should have taxpayer, they should be considered too big to fail. And so we may be stepping in it big time. For those that are not from agricultural area, that refers to, no. Yes, sir.
It sounds like from what you say that starting with the ability to securitize mortgages, that just about everything that you save plus incentives flows from that. And so you said that the ability to securitize started around 1970. And so have we been in this possible pit ever since then?
Well, Warren Buffett described derivatives as a weapon of mass destruction, and he described that in 2004. I would argue that during the 80s and 90s it wasn't that big of a deal, but it just really grew dramatically in the late 1990s and 2000. The Europeans are very concerned about regulating derivatives, and I know the Japanese have a panel looking at it as well. So it's not just a U.S. problem, it's around the world. One of the things that Dodd-Frank is attempting to do is take the derivatives and put them onto a more transparent environment. Right now, they're private transactions, and we don't tend to regulate private transactions with the exception of cars and real estate and a few others. So it's an attempt to put it, to add some transparency and to keep commercial banks from participating in it. But I would argue the problems are still there, yes.
I think it was the spring or summer of 2007, the Washington Post ran a series of articles based on interviews with mortgage brokers who had originated these subprime loans. And one anecdote I will never forget concerns a young woman who went to this mortgage broker and said she and her boyfriend wanted to take out this mortgage, as I recall, it was over $500,000. And he got her to fill out the paperwork and said, but at the closing, your boyfriend has to be here too. And the closing date arrives and she comes in alone and he says, I told you, your boyfriend had to be here too. And she bursts into tears and explains that he's in jail.
Whoops.
Now, the question, I have heard several times a fear expressed of a bubble in the student loans. but I've never seen that explained. Could you explain that?
I can't. I've seen some of the same reports you have, and Sallie Mae is the federal agency that used to be involved. But no, I can't explain it because I've seen the default rates, and the default rates of student loans have gone up dramatically. And now I understand that a freshly minted lawyer comes out with a $100,000 student loan. A college graduate that has borrowed, I think the average debt level is $24,000, $25,000, and that's more than a half a year of their income, but I haven't looked at it other than seeing the reports. But yeah, good question.
I just wanted to comment. I liked your chart, which showed the cost of building as opposed to the price for the house. Well, I happened to buy one of those houses, and if I had consulted with my insurance company before I bought that house, I wouldn't have paid that much because they wouldn't insure it for the...
Really?
That's right. They wouldn't insure it for what it would cost to replace the house.
Sure, sure. Yeah, because they're on the hook for many insurance policies have the replacement clause. So, yes. Wow.
Going back to Glass-Steagall.
Yes.
What are the chances of putting that genie back in the bottle, particularly with separating any deposits that are federally insured or federally backed with taxpayer funds from high-risk investments? And with all these different securitization, who owns the property when it goes default?
And actually, that's the last part of it is a very interesting phenomenon, because one of the things that took place is that many of these were not recorded in the normal fashion. They were recorded on paper, and they didn't have the transfer of paper from one investor to the next, you know, from the commercial bank or the lender to the investors. And so there is some real question who owns it, and that's part of the settlement that was announced yesterday. But to go to the first part of the question, could you put it back? Could you go back to having just a commercial bank separate from an investment bank, separate from a merchant bank? England is doing that. The United Kingdom is moving to that model, and they are arguing that commercial banks that have, in effect, government support just like we do, the government insurance support just like we have here, they've argued that Minister of Treasury has argued, or the Exchequer has argued that the commercial banks should be just, in effect, commodities. I mean, they should be where you and I go to do our checking and our savings, and we know it's safe and secure. My undergraduate degree was in political science, but I don't think I could predict politics today. I don't think I can predict it because of the lobbying that would take place from the financial industry to keep that from happening. I would argue it does make sense. Commercial banks should be very safe, secure places where you and I can do our transactions and without any worries. But I don't see it happening. But I can't predict the future because politics in today's world, who knows? I don't know who's next. But
Hi, I'm Marvin Edwards.
I hear a voice.
There was a great program on PBS, Frontline. They did a show called The Warning, and it was about Brooksley Bourne, who was head of the CFTC back in like 1997, 98 or something like that. And she tried to get the CFTC to come up with a set of regulations for the shadow banking, for the derivatives and so forth. But she got undermined by Alan Greenspan, who believed ideologically that capitalism would regulate itself and you didn't need these regulations. And so Congress essentially stripped them of power, and she was unable to do anything, and she ended up resigning. But the problem was exhibiting itself from time to time back in like 1998 and so forth.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The Commodities Future Trading Commission was set up originally to regulate commodities and the future contracts of agricultural and some metals. And that's where it originally started. And then the derivatives, in effect, came under them. Her predecessor was Wendy Graham. On her very last day as the chair of the Commodities Future Trading Commission, she deregulated derivatives. And so the chair that you're describing came in and re-regulated them. Well, Wendy Graham, her very next job was director of Enron. And to make the story even more interesting, it was Phil Graham that put in a 242-page amendment to the last budget bill that Bill Clinton signed in 2000. He was the senator from Texas and majority leader at the time. He put in a 242-page amendment at the last minute in the budget bill, unrelated, that totally deregulated. And when you're describing limiting the Commodities Future Trading Commission's power, that was where it came from. And it totally deregulated derivatives and securities in 2000. And going back to the question of whether people have second thoughts, I wonder whether the political folks, the congressmen and senators that signed, that agreed to that amendment, now have second thoughts. But
for the presentation, I think all of us have really enjoyed it. I recently read a book by Ed Burton.
Oh, yes, indeed.
One of your colleagues.
One of my old friends as
yes.
well. Yes, nice guy.
And your briefing follows this book very well.
Thank you.
That was great. One of the thoughts I've had as you're giving this lecture, we've sort of learned all this over the last 10 or 15 years. Isn't it sort of like a Ponzi scheme?
Well, the Ponzi scheme is an interesting metaphor because it explains my argument that the regulators are outwitted by the
yes.
industry and by individuals. So we all know Madoff. Well, what many people don't know is that in 2000, it's around 2004, a whistleblower, a competitor of Madoff, wrote a 34-page mathematical proof that what Madoff was doing could not be possible. And I gave that to my intermediate investments class to work through the math, and sure enough, it couldn't be possible. The SEC received that, looked at it, thought about it, did nothing, because the folks that were looking at it were primarily legally trained rather than economists or financial analysts, and didn't have the math ability to comprehend the math. And I will admit that my third year students couldn't have, but my fourth year students could have and did. Work through the math, but as you're describing the Ponzi scheme, there's some similarities, and it's I would argue it's because the regulators really can't keep up and don't know. And yeah,
I have a follow up to that one. Would you have a comment on this alleged fiscal cliff coming up again in February and March? I know you would have a comment. You may not be able to give it to all of us, but it looks to me like we're at $16.6 trillion in the debt, and I understand from reading a lot of things that it's going to be $18 trillion, and then it's going to be $19 trillion, and then it's going to be $20 trillion. And it seems to be politically unsolvable. I know you said you don't do politics, but I'll take that back. Do you have an idea when we're really going to hit a fiscal cliff and we have to stop going to the 20 trillions, the 21s? I would appreciate any comment you have on that. I know that's a tough one.
It is a very tough one. I smile because in 1982, I had a student who said his father was pushing the balanced budget amendment. And I've always been concerned about deficits, but I said, you know, Congress is going to do the right thing. We don't have to worry about, I mean, they're going to get a handle on it, and it's not going to get out of. I wish now that in 1982 they would have passed the balanced budget amendment, would have kept us from getting to where we are now. I mean, it has been growing since then. But so you're right. I'm not going to try to predict the future in politics.
Okay, you're consistent with everybody else, I guess. That question, too.
Well, that's good.
Given the age of this audience, they're probably more interested in reverse mortgages than first mortgages. What words of wisdom do you have as they look at those instruments?
Sure. I've been somewhat optimistic about reverse mortgages. Reverse mortgages, when in effect, you promised to either pay the bank when you sell a house or when you die, it'll come out of it. The early indications of the reverse mortgage early on is their fees were much, much too high. And the concern I now have, the fees have dropped. The concern I now have is watching the ads on television, they're going to end up pulling in folks that really don't need to do a reverse mortgage. And the other big fear I have is many folks are, rather than taking, so a reverse mortgage, in effect, you're saying to the lender, allow my mortgage principal to go up over time. Pay me a certain amount of money. And the original intent was to pay it over, say, a monthly basis so that you could live on the value of the equity in your house, the fact, the difference between its fair market value and the mortgage would gradually grow, and most lenders allowed it to grow up to, say, 80% or so. But what people are doing now is they're taking all the money out at day one rather than a monthly. And so they're going to end up with the same situation as the subprime lenders, unable to repay the loan. And so I think it's great in concept. It's great if you really work it through and think through what you're going to do with the money, but don't take the money out to speculate, to buy stocks or bonds or Porsche or whatever. So as a person of the same age, it's a very attractive, but be careful with it. So, I was asked by Bank Rate probably about 1996 about using home equity loans. And I said, yeah, home equity loans make sense. I borrowed against a home equity loan to send my kids to college. I borrowed to buy a car because the interest is tax deductible, whereas a credit card or a loan is not. But I said, be very careful, because you can walk to work if you lose your car, if it gets repossessed. But where are you going to sleep if you don't have a home? And the same thing is going to happen, I'm afraid, in some of the reverse mortgages. But if it's used right, used as a way of taking money out of your house over time, I think that's great. Yes, ma'am.
Well, it's very strange. I think I read Den of Thieves, which I thought was an interesting
book. Oh, yes,
indeed.
Den of Thieves is a book probably in the middle 90s, yes. But yeah.
But you go in the Bible and you have Jesus going and turning the money changers' tables over, and I don't think you're going to change human nature. My father was a financial officer in Philadelphia during the 30s, took night courses at Wharton, and sort of tried to educate me, but I'm not very good in math anyway. But men are like sheep. We had Dutch bulb thing.
Yes,
and
the tulip bulb of the 17th century.
People are going to find a way around it, no matter what you do, so that they can start all over again. You know, the guys that jumped out of windows in the 30s, and then...
Well, they didn't start over again.
And then we had... And then we had, who is some man they put in jail? I can't think of his name, but he was selling a whole lot of stuff. I'm embarrassed. Yeah.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you that, and you really make a good point to conclude this, and that is that human nature is not going to change. And you're exactly right.
We have one more question.
Yes, sir. Tom.
Thank you for your presentation. One of your earlier slides, you showed the list of banks that purchased the mortgage originators. Do you know if the banks bought the originators or they were sold the idea by the investment bankers?
I think it's a function of both. And the interesting thing is many of the subprime lender executives that I worked with got out when they sold it to the banks. And so they made their millions and got out of the business. So, yeah, great point.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you. My pleasure. My pleasure.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.